The three men are charged with hate crimes and attempted kidnapping, and also face potential life sentences. Jury selection in that case is scheduled to begin on 7th of February. "I'll be there every day," she said. "They need to answer to those charges as well." Wanda Cooper-Jones said federal prosecutors had contacted her recently and asked if she would be comfortable with a plea deal. She said she told them that she preferred to see the federal case go to trial. Friday's question of parole eligibility resonated differently for the three men. For Travis McMichael, it was about the possibility of being released as early as his mid-60s. But Gregory McMichael, his father, would be in his 90s if he were given the chance to go before a parole board. Likewise, Mr. Bryan would be in his 80s. Robert Rubin, a lawyer for Travis McMichael, argued that his client might have acted recklessly but was trying to look out for his neighbors. Robert Rubin said a maximum sentence for his client would constitute vengeance, and said that a parole board should have a chance to consider freeing Mr. McMichael. Laura Hogue, a lawyer for Gregory McMichael, said he had no criminal record and had carried out thousands of acts of kindness in his lifetime. Kevin Gough, a lawyer for Mr. Bryan, noted that his client had publicly expressed remorse. Mr. Gough made what he admitted was a long-shot argument that the judge should consider a sentence for Mr. Bryan that was effectively more lenient than the mandated minimum. At trial, defense lawyers argued that Travis McMichael had acted in self-defense when he shot Ahmed Arbery. They also argued that the pursuit of Mr. Arbery was legal under a citizen's arrest law that was later significantly dismantled by Georgia lawmakers. Prosecutors had given strong indications before the trial that they would make racism an important component of their case, but in the end, several allegations of racism were not introduced to the nearly all-white jury, either for strategic reasons or because of hurdles presented by the rules of evidence. Instead, the lead prosecutor, Donikowski, made a plea to jurors' sense of basic fairness and argued that the men had violated rules of common sense when they decided to take the law into their own hands. One of the few hints of racial motive came in her closing argument when Linda Donikowski said Mr. Arbery had been attacked because he was a black man running down the street. But the accusations of racism that jurors never heard in the state case could potentially be introduced next month in the federal court. They include photographic evidence of Travis McMichael's truck, which was adorned with a vanity plate with the design of the old Georgia state flag, which incorporates the Confederate battle flag. Court records show that prosecutors had considered introducing what they described as other racial evidence, including Facebook posts or text messages from the three men. In a pretrial hearing, prosecutors read a text message from November of 2019 in which Travis McMichael used a racist slur about black people as he described the idea of shooting a crackhead with gold teeth. In a federal court filing in late December, the lawyer for Mr. Bryan asked the court to exclude evidence that suggested Mr. Bryan had racial animus towards black people, including racially insensitive text messages he made around the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday, and witness testimony that would suggest Bryan did not approve of his adopted daughter dating an African-American man. A Georgia state investigator has said that Mr. Bryan told authorities that he heard Travis McMichael use a racist slur shortly after shooting Ahmed Arbery. Mr. McMichael's lawyer disputed this claim. That allegation may be difficult to bring before a jury if Mr. Bryan declines to take the witness stand, which would deny Travis McMichael his constitutional right to cross-examine a witness against him. According to Justice Department statistics, more than 90% of hate crime defendants adjudicated in U.S. District Court between 2005 and 2019 were convicted. But Paige Pate, a Georgia lawyer and legal analyst, said this trial could prove to be challenging for prosecutors. Racist statements alone, he said, would not be enough to secure a conviction. Proving somebody's a racist doesn't make it a hate crime, he said. You've got to show that the crime was connected to those feelings. In addition to hate crimes, the federal indictment that was issued in April also charges the three men with attempted kidnapping. Both of the McMichaels armed themselves before chasing Ahmed Arbery, and both are charged with using a firearm during a violent crime.
Communique.
It's been 2 years now since the United States assassinated General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Both these men were known as formidable tacticians and military commanders, but also revered as national heroes in Iran, Iraq, and the region at large. General Qasem Soleimani was an Iranian general who headed the Quds Force, a branch of the Iranian Revolution Guard Corps, the IRGC. Meanwhile, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, an Iraqi, headed Kata'ib Hezbollah and was the deputy commander of the Hashd al-Sha'bi, known in English as the Popular Mobilization Units, or PMU. Both these men played a significant role in defeating al-Qaeda and ISIS, or Daesh, in Syria and Iraq. They formed an integral part of the axis of resistance and were instrumental in Iran's larger support for resistance movements in West Asia, including the Palestinian resistance and Hezbollah. I wanted to ask the following questions. What did the work carried out by Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis mean for the region? How have things changed since their murder? And did the Americans succeed in their goal of weakening the axis of resistance? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. On January 3rd, 2020, a commercial flight arriving from Damascus landed in Baghdad Airport. Aboard the plane was General Qasem Soleimani, who had come on an official visit at the invitation of the then Iraqi Prime Minister. General Soleimani was met by Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Meanwhile, circling overhead were a number of American aircraft. As Soleimani's convoy was leaving the airport, a Reaper drone fired on them, killing Soleimani and Abu Mahdi, along with four members of the IRGC and four members of the PMU. The shock of this incident was immediately apparent. Chris Murphy, a Democratic senator from Connecticut, described Trump's assassination of Soleimani as the equivalent of the Iranians killing the U.S. Defense Secretary.
As to how to manage the fallout that comes from such a drastic action. This is the equivalent of the Iranians assassinating the U.S. Secretary of Defense. If the Iranians were to assassinate the U.S. Secretary of Defense, we would consider that an act of war and we would respond disproportionately.
Trump knew full well that Iran would respond. How could they not? After all, Soleimani was one of the most important and powerful men in Iran, if not the entire region. The day after the assassination, Trump went on an all-caps tirade on Twitter, saying that if Iran responded, they would be hit, quote, very fast and very hard. He also threatened to bomb Iran's cultural sites, a war crime under international law. No U.S. president before Trump had dared to kill General Soleimani, knowing full well that it would be unjustifiable and could easily lead to war. Soleimani's body was brought to Iran to begin the funeral processions and national mourning. In multiple cities, literally millions of people flocked to the streets to mourn the slain commander. Just take a look at these clips from the funeral processions. General Qasem Soleimani was buried on January 7th in his hometown, Kerman. After his burial, had to be postponed twice because of how large the crowds were, a testament to his popularity. On January 8th, Iran began Operation Martyr Soleimani. In response to the assassination, Iran sent a barrage of rockets, firing a dozen ballistic missiles at the Ain al-Assad air base in Iraq. This base housed foreign troops, mainly Americans, and is located in Iraq, west of Baghdad. This volley of rockets leveled the base. There were no fatalities, however, it said that scores of U.S. troops were injured, many diagnosed with traumatic brain injuries. Now, the framing of this attack is again very funny, because in the mainstream media, they were asking if Iran was ready to de-escalate the situation, as if Iran had just assassinated a U.S. official. And also saying things like, well, Iran is lucky. They're lucky they didn't kill any U.S. troops when they launched those missiles. Otherwise, we would have responded. Well, no, Iran didn't just randomly decide to launch missiles at the Ain al-Assad airbase for no reason or because they don't like your clothes or your hair. They launched the missiles at Ain al-Assad because you just committed an act of war and murdered an Iranian government official. It is, in fact, the United States who is lucky that Iran didn't do more. Now, the legality of such a strike has been at the center of debate about Soleimani's killing. Donald Trump claimed that Soleimani was planning an imminent attack against Americans. Then-Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said that killing Soleimani, quote, saved American lives.
It's the right decision. We got it right. The Department of Defense did excellent work. And the president had a entirely legal, appropriate, and a basis, as well as a decision that fit perfectly within our strategy.
It's probably a good time to mention that Mike Pompeo was also the former director of the CIA, where he also did this.
I was the CIA director. We lied, we cheated, we stole. It's like we had entire training courses.
Neither Trump nor Pompeo could provide any evidence to substantiate their claims about Soleimani. At first, they said that there was an imminent threat, but couldn't give a timeline when. They said days or weeks. Then Pompeo said that they had killed Soleimani because of something that happened in the days before the strike. But those are two completely different things. Something cannot be imminent if it's in the past. And it's not hard to see that Pompeo and Trump are lying and had no evidence of any so-called imminent threat. It seems the only reason Trump and Pompeo made this ridiculous claim about self-defense is because it's the only way Trump could legally justify the assassination at home under U.S. law. In 1973, the War's Power Resolution was passed, requiring the president to notify Congress within 48 hours of taking military action. In the Trump administration's legal rationale for assassinating Soleimani, they cited the Authorization for the Use of Military Force of 2002, also known as the AUMF of 2002, which was passed under the Bush presidency for the invasion of Iraq in 2003. This is one of the most extreme, exaggerated interpretations of the AUMF 2002, which, by the way, was authorized against Iraq, not Iran. And nevertheless, that's just U.S. law, not international law. So just because Trump cites the AUMF of 2002, that doesn't suddenly make it okay on the world stage. Remember, the invasion of Iraq in 2003 was a war of aggression and is considered illegal under international law. Trump also claimed that, quote, the strike against Soleimani in Iraq was taken in the United States national self-defense, as recognized in Article 51 of the United Nations Charter, in response to a series of escalating armed attacks that Iran and Iran-supported militias had already conducted against the United States. Well, speaking of the United Nations disagrees. Agnès Callamard is the UN Special Rapporteur on extrajudicial, summary, and arbitrary killings. She concluded the U.S. murder of General Soleimani to be unlawful and illegal under international law. In July 2020, the Special Rapporteur published a report in which she examined the assassination of Qasem Soleimani. She rejected the United States' attempts to justify his murder. She found the U.S. to be in violation of the U.N. Charter and that, quote, the course of action taken by the U.S. was unlawful. Article 2.4 of the U.N. Charter forbids the use of force by one U.N. member state against another. She concluded that the United States broke this law. The examples of imminent threats provided by the U.S. were in fact not imminent, but things that had already happened months before. Some of them were not even actual attacks, but rather perceived threats, while other examples included things like Iran shooting down a U.S. drone that had illegally entered Iranian airspace. Sina Rahmani is a translator, scholar, and writer. His work has appeared in Iranian Studies, Radical History Review, and Public Books, among others. He's also the creator of the East is a Podcast, a podcast that takes a critical look at the history of the present in West Asia and North Africa. I asked him what he thought the motivations were behind the United States assassination of General Soleimani.
So two men represented and were, in addition to their own work as military commanders, effective ambassadors for their cause and their alliances, movers in their own political environments, and sort of the military aspect, and those aspects of their personality, they both were symbols of a resistance to the U.S. imperial agenda in the region that's been unfolding for three decades, in different ways and in different backdrops. But they were the symbol of an alliance between certain forces in the region. They named themselves the Axis of Resistance. But whatever name you give to themselves, it's really just a anti-colonial sort of resistance front or anti-imperial resistance front. So that's the kind of general answer. But in reality, I think there are the sort of cold political calculations. I think that at the time we were in the midst of this kind of unfolding crisis, generated essentially at the behest of a highly placed source of individuals who more or less purchased foreign policy, and that was the sort of signature effect of the Trump presidency, is that he was honest in a way. The Saudis and certain factions among Zionists sort of hedged their bets and they invested in this guy. And that paid off in that unfolding crisis in those 2 years. And this was, I don't want to say culmination, but in effect the most dramatic sort of theater of that unfolding drama that was ultimately begun by Washington, begun in those sort of like secret, you know, and unfolded under the course of those 2 years and resulted in the assassination of these two men. Extrajudicial killing, you know. It was totally illegal, and I mean, that's obvious.
I mean, we mentioned these cold, calculated foreign policy decisions. On that front, what was the goal? Why were the Americans trying to assassinate Soleimani and Abu Mahdi in terms of foreign policy objectives? And did they succeed? You know, if their goal was to change the Middle East, do you believe that they succeeded in that? And how do you think their deaths have affected the region?
In the sense of, like, you know, cold, hard calculations, nothing changes. I mean, nothing changes in the real. There are these two men played historic roles, yes. But ultimately, they were reflections of a system of resistance that's been in production for a long time. And those systems had been tested in the last two decades of cataclysmic war being waged from all corners of the entire sort of West Asian region. And the Iranians emerged. There's a historic development in the last two decades. You know, this has been my adult life, is watching the U.S. empire make this insane, you know, like cataclysmic leap, you know, of ridiculous proportions, and it's trying to establish its, like, you know, insane goals of regime change. You know, what was it, 7 countries in 5 years or 5 countries in 7 years? The General Wesley Clark thing. This is one chapter in a larger story of unceasing war fought by the U.S. against Iran, against its allies, and against anyone who doesn't want to go about being, you know, taking its place in the supply chain, which is what it wants from ultimately the entire region, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, basically the resistance goes on because it's a whole system of, countering colonialism, imperialism.
I mean, at a certain point, 40% of the U.S. military was surrounding Iran. I mean, think of that. That was the first phase. And then the second phase came their mercenaries, for the, you know, which their first class one was ISIS, and then the rest of their allies, the supposed allies. And it was just like this team that rocked up and spent the last 10 years destroying the countries that they hadn't destroyed. And the response to that was what Qasem Soleimani's legacy, and we undercut the value of Abu Mahdi's, right? We should obviously sort of talk about that. But like both of these men and the forces that they represented and the alliances they represented and what they were, you know, leading members of, but ultimately were part of a larger sort of organism, that represented something historic. That's on the scale of the Spanish Civil War, where you had this fascist transnational alliance, except it was bigger than one country. And the response to it was a popular mobilization of normal people taking up weapons. And that's the legacy of the Hashd al-Sha'bi, in the popular mobilization units, which were not a creation of Iran. It was, in fact, a creation of Iraqi Grand Ayatollah, right? That was Ali Sistani. So there's a lot of silliness when it comes to talking about Iran, and one of the worst things is this totally racist and totally bankrupt Orientalist thing of Iranians are the only ones who control things and the rest are their puppets. I mean, this is, it's just, you know, it's like Cold War stuff reinvented.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
So we know the excuses provided by the U.S. are not true. The United Nations and a large part of the world reject them. So why did the United States assassinate General Soleimani? The murder of Haj Qasem was part of a string of American hostilities against Iran. Trump quit the nuclear deal in 2018. Then he reimposed sanctions on Iran, crippling its economy, flying drones and bombers into Iranian airspace. Trump and Pompeo claimed that Soleimani endangered American lives. No, he didn't. America endangered its own troops' lives, never mind the people of Iraq, Syria, and others, by invading countries on the other side of the planet. This is not your turf. No one endangers American lives in the Middle East except America. You cannot invade foreign countries and then expect people to just shut up and tolerate being occupied. It's also quite amusing listening to the Western media try to explain who Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis was. They say that he fought against American interests in Iraq, as if the Americans have any business being there in the first place after they invaded and occupied the country. That's like if you're talking about the French resistance in World War II and you say that the French resistance is opposing German interests in France. That's a very funny way to say that someone is resisting a foreign military occupation. Now, the United States claims that Soleimani was a terrorist, but Soleimani was killing terrorists, specifically the ones in Syria, funded and supported by the United States, Israel, and their allies. Soleimani's role in the region was an undeniably important one. Most generals today, whether in Iran or the United States, are unheard of. Most Americans probably have no idea who General Petraeus is, and he's one of the more known military leaders in the U.S. In Iran, with General Soleimani, it's a completely different story. He's a national hero and was known as being charismatic and a general who led from the battlefield, not a desk general who sat comfortably away from the front. The Americans love to pretend that they care about minorities. They pretend to care for the Christians in Iraq and Syria. When Mike Pompeo spoke in Occupy Jerusalem, he claimed that General Soleimani was responsible for killing thousands of Christians across the Middle East. This is one of the biggest lies that has ever come out of Mike Pompeo's mouth, which is really saying something.
Qasem Soleimani. This is the man most responsible for the murder and maiming of hundreds of American soldiers and thousands of Christians across the Middle East.
Neither Soleimani nor Iran has ever killed or targeted Christians in the Middle East. On the contrary, Christians who come from the Middle East, like myself, owe a huge debt of gratitude to General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi because these men and their troops are the ones who protected Christians from being killed by Daesh. Meanwhile, it is the United States and Israel and people like Mike Pompeo who were funding Daesh and Jabhat al-Nusra and terrorist groups like that, which purposely targeted religious minorities. This is why when Haj Qasem was assassinated, Arab churches in the region held mass for Soleimani and Christians prayed for him. Soleimani is not only dear to the Iranians, but to all the people of West Asia and the Levant who understood the role that he played in fighting the imperialists and their proxies in the region. Dr. Fuad Izadi is an associate professor of American studies at the University of Tehran. His work focuses on United States-Iran relations and U.S. public diplomacy. Izadi has also appeared as a political commentator on various international media outlets such as RT, Sky News, and Al Jazeera. I asked him about the important work General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi carried out in protecting minorities in the Middle East. Well, one thing that isn't really talked about enough is that Haj Qasem, Abu Mahdi, they really helped to protect minorities in the Middle East. Christians, Muslims, you know, everyone alike realized the important role that they played. Even after his death, after Soleimani's death, we saw Christians holding mass for him in churches, praying for Haj Qasem. I mean, isn't that a powerful example, a powerful testament to his defense of all kinds of ethnic groups and religions living in this region, defending them from terrorism and imperialism?
You know, this is something that the Western corporate media has generally censored, the fact that Christians in Syria, the Christians in Iraq, were under attack by ISIS unjustly. Islam does not teach its followers to kill Christians. That's not part of Islamic teaching. And realizing that fact, it was actually Qasem Soleimani that was defending the Syrian people and the Iraqi people, no matter what religion was. And it was very much true, as you said, that after his assassination, Christians in this part of the world lost someone who was helping them survive attacks by people who claimed to be Muslim, but they were not really following the teachings of Islam. And this very fact is, hardly see any coverage of that very fact, because Qasem Soleimani was supposed to be a terrorist. You cannot have a terrorist defending Christian. That's not going to be the frame that Western news media outlets want to present. But there's a lot of hypocrisy when it comes to how the media coverage in this part of the world is actually done. It was Qasem Soleimani that highlighted this hypocrisy throughout his life.
You know, one of the things the United States likes to take credit for is supposedly defeating Daesh. Even until now, they claim that they're in Iraq because they're fighting Daesh. Realistically speaking, does the credit go to the Americans, or does it go to Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis? Because a lot of people seem to think that they should take the credit for helping to bring the downfall of Daesh. Do you agree that they had a much more significant role in combating all these foreign fighters, the terrorist groups backed by NATO and the Arab countries in the Persian Gulf?
Who was fighting terrorism? Qasem Soleimani, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis in Iraq. We have numerous accounts of the U.S. actually helping ISIS directly or indirectly. This is something that even some Western sources wrote after the assassination of Qasem Soleimani, that the United States assassinated the most important individual in the fight against ISIS. The U.S. talked about fighting ISIS. In a lot of cases, they actually helped ISIS. And the country that fought ISIS, the military commander that engaged in that, was Qasem Soleimani. So that's, if somebody's interested in fighting terrorism, somebody's interested in establishing peace, they should look at Qasem Soleimani as a hero.
So in the last weeks, we've seen reports that the Israelis were involved in the attack, or at least they've admitted to being involved in the attack. Trump allegedly said that he felt used by the Israelis. What do you think of that? Do you agree with that assessment, that the Israelis used him? And what do you make of the Israeli role in the murder of Haj Qasem and Abu Mahdi?
You know, we had a retired Israeli general that just a few days ago said that Israel is doing well. And we had other accounts that actually pointed out that Qasem Soleimani was someone that not only fought against U.S. domination, and overall, you have a situation where Israelis are not actually in a better shape today when you compare their standing now to what happened to when Qasem Soleimani was alive. You remember just a few months ago, we had the resistance in Gaza, in Palestine, actually fighting back.
In the Middle East, General Soleimani is considered a hero because he defeated terrorists like Daesh and Al-Qaeda. In the West, they call him a terrorist because he defeated their proxies, Daesh and Al-Qaeda. If the goal of the assassination was to cripple Iran or hurt Iran's military capabilities, that has obviously failed. Iran is stronger than it was 2 years ago by all reasonable metrics, Look how its military capability has grown and how the regional makeup has shifted in its favor. The United States had to flee Afghanistan. It can no longer sustain its occupation of Iraq. Its war against Syria has failed. If the goal was to demoralize the axis of resistance, that has also failed. The Houthis in Yemen are making huge advances as Saudi Arabia realizes it can no longer sustain this war against them. In Iraq, Soleimani's assassination prompted the Iraqi parliament to vote to tell the Americans to leave. And the Hashd al-Shaabi have become an even stronger force in Iraq, keeping the U.S. occupation on its toes. And while sanctions in Syria continue to take a strong toll, the project for regime change has failed and looks weaker and weaker by the day as Arab countries begin normalizing ties again with Syria. In Lebanon, Hezbollah has brought in fuel and helped to mitigate the effects of the de facto American siege with the help of Iran. And finally, Iran itself is in an even stronger position than it was before. It has more leverage in its nuclear program, a stronger relationship with China and Russia, and deeper ties with its neighboring countries. So by killing Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, did the United States succeed in weakening Iran or weakening the axis of resistance? The answer is clearly no. Iran and the resistance axis, they don't function like the USA or some random country. You cannot just kill one man, one leader, and then think, oh, everything is over. Now, while General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi were certainly formidable tacticians and commanders in their own right, together they formed part of a system, part of the resistance. And you cannot defeat the resistance by simply killing one or two important individuals. Haj Qasem and Abu Mahdi played a crucial role. This is undeniable. But the objectives of resisting against occupation, imperialism, and neocolonialism continue. And this is something that will only end with the complete liberation of the Middle East and Palestine. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
By no means has voting blue meant a change for the better. In fact, the only real difference between Biden and Trump in terms of foreign policy is that instead of mean tweets, more respectful language is used to give the new president the veneer of respectability, says Robert Inlakesh, journalist, in an article titled Biden's Diplomacy is Back, Falls Flat as 2021 West Asia Policy, a Miserable Flop. Stay tuned for the first part of this article, please. Despite President Joe Biden having claimed earlier this year that diplomacy is back and that he would end the war in Yemen, revive the Iran nuclear deal and settle several other issues. In reality, his West Asia region foreign policy has been just as detrimental to the region as was that of his predecessor. This war has to end. We are ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales, Biden said in early February during his first address to the U.S. public on his administration's foreign policy approach. It was a speech that saw him showered with the praise of his supporters, yet we are now in early January 2022, and the war has only intensified, with UN experts estimating that the total death toll by the end of the year will be 377,000. To make things even worse, as Saudi Arabia's bombs target urban centers in Yemen's capital, Sana'a, including the country's primary airport and a maternity hospital, the U.S. just approved another $650 million weapon sales to Riyadh. Instead of withdrawing their support for the Saudis' offensive actions and ending weapon sales, the Biden administration has done the exact opposite and took no action when the war escalated just weeks after the president's statements, igniting an ongoing bloody battle for control of oil-rich Ma'reb province. Yemen is far from an isolated case of the Biden administration saying one thing and doing the opposite, but is perhaps the most urgent of all West Asia region matters to resolve, given the sheer number of civilian casualties that await perpetuation of the status quo. Next on the list of this year's West Asia region catastrophes is Afghanistan, where Biden fulfilled his promise of withdrawal. But with the sudden collapse of the U.S.-backed Afghan government, the country soon fell to the Taliban. In August, infamous scenes of Afghans falling to their deaths after holding on to departing U.S. planes, coupled with a helicopter lift spotted aiding U.S. embassy workers, saw comparisons made with Washington's infamous withdrawal from Saigon in 1975. Violence by American troops was meted out against civilians during the early stages of the Taliban takeover and did not end until every last American troop left. The most notoriously bloody incident was a drone strike that targeted and killed 10 Afghan civilians, seven of whom were children. Zamari Ahmadi, a 36-year-old who worked for the California-based aid organization Nutrition and Education International, NEI, was killed in that drone strike, along with six of his nieces and nephews, symbolizing the lack of protection Afghans got even when working with the United States. So how did the U.S. decide to close the chapter of the failed $2.26 trillion Afghanistan war? Did we punish those responsible for the murder of an aid worker and his family? You guessed it. Not only did the U.S. government defend its actions, it refused to hold anyone to account for one of the last war crimes it committed on Afghan soil in 2021. What then to make of U.S. attempts to righteously blame the Taliban for their acts when Washington itself refuses to hold its own forces to the high standards they expect of others? Washington is also currently freezing approximately $9.5 billion in assets and loans, leaving the newly established government in Kabul unable to feed a starving population suffering under an economic crisis. This does not mean that the Taliban deserve a free pass here for their actions But neither is this a simple morality play of good and evil, black and white. What the Biden administration's actions attest to is an environment of impunity that shielded coalition forces from accountability, as Washington's withdrawal proved both tactically and strategically disastrous.
He who asks questions cannot avoid the answers. A simple question.
On the 3rd of January 2020, Iran's most powerful military commander, General Qasem Soleimani, was killed by a U.S. military airstrike in Iraq.
The 62-year-old general was the key military leader in the Middle East and led operations as head of Iran's elite Quds Force. The general was widely regarded as a heroic national figure, in part because he was instrumental in the destruction of the ISIL terrorist organization after the failure of the West to achieve this outcome. The general was killed at Baghdad airport, along with other Iran-backed militia figures, in a strike ordered by US President Donald Trump. 2 years later, the assassination remains unexplained and almost forgotten by the Western media. Yet his killing provoked a wave of mourning and rage against the assassinating country, America. Indeed, to the public in Iran and to many abroad, part of the impact was to serve as yet another example of Western military policy carried out to the illegal killing of a senior member of another country's military force.
How many people in Britain are aware of General Soleimani's essential role in fighting ISIL? And how would people here feel if such a key player in this country were assassinated by a foreign power? Simple questions with important answers. And let's begin by establishing the extent of public awareness of the general, his work, and his assassination. We asked the public in London if they'd heard of Qasem Soleimani, and if not, whether they could guess his country of origin. Here's what they said. There's a person called Qasem Soleimani. Have you heard of him, or do you think maybe you've heard of him? Can you guess what he does, or maybe where he came from, even if it's a guess?
Iran, maybe. He's from Iran, and he was a general. That's what I heard.
General Soleimani was primarily responsible for destroying the terrorist organization ISIL after the West proved unable to do so. Is the public aware of this? And what do they think of the fact this achievement was carried out by an Iranian general? What do you think of that achievement? And were you aware of the fact an Iranian general basically was responsible for killing ISIL?
No, not at all. I thought it was probably a combination of the Iraqis and the Americans.
Did you know that achievement? What do you think about it?
No, I didn't. I didn't know that. I think that's great.
Are you surprised that it was actually an Iranian general who basically led this? And what do you think of that achievement?
I don't. I'm not surprised in the slightest. I think that generally people who are local and have the knowledge and power and vested interest and know their communities and know the people are going to be the people best suited and best able because they're going to have the support of local people because they're from there and they want to do it.
Have you seen anything in the media about him?
No. The only reason why I think I know this is, was he targeted? And he was killed by a drone attack, is that right? Yeah, okay, so I think I do know him. It was the Americans. Yeah, sure, right. Yeah, I know who we're talking about now.
No, I didn't know it, but obviously it is quite an achievement. ISIL was quite a terrifying organisation. Yeah. So, well done him. But
now that you've mentioned the guy does ring a bell.
There's not a huge amount in the media. You get sort of some news stories and obviously some things filter through, but it's just the stories don't necessarily end. Names don't always ring bells, so I think unless you're really trying to keep up to date with everything, it's very easy to miss us. There's an awful lot that goes on in the world.
I don't know what surprised me anymore. So I'm surprised that you don't hear about it on the media, I guess. But also, I don't know, on the media you hear random stuff, so I guess it's surprising, but also it's not.
I'm actually quite surprised to hear this, I'm not going to lie, especially because we haven't heard anything about this in the media, I mean, especially not in London, so... Yeah, actually, very surprised.
General Soleimani has not been widely recognized for his work in destroying ISIL. But what would have been the reaction if a British or an American general, instead of an Iranian one, had brought down that terrorist movement?
I'm surprised. I don't know either. I'm not huge on history. I don't know a lot. But, I'm surprised.
If a British or an American general had been responsible for destroying ISIL, how much coverage do you think that would have got? How much of a hero would that person have been instead of being an Iranian general?
He would probably have a huge statue built up somewhere here, maybe in central London. Being in London, that would be a huge deal for the British people. I wish there was more recognition.
I'm sure there would have been a lot of press publicity about it. There was when they took down Saddam Hussein. Yeah, so I would imagine it would have been somewhat similar.
There would have been a lot more publicity around it. They would have made a lot more out of that fact that he was British or American. Yeah.
Why was the same not happening for the Iranian general?
I don't know, but maybe the media outlets are very, very biased and have a very, very narrow view on what they want to show and what people are interested in.
Britain seems to just be very inward-looking these days. I don't know. And then, of course, I think the media also report what they think people will be interested in, I guess. There's a lot of interesting things happening that we never get to hear of, you know.
I think I'd have heard an awful lot more about it if it had been a British or an American general who'd done that. You'd have had it all over the news. We probably would have had someone with knighthood honours by now. And, just... would have had a lot more generally in the general consciousness.
Would the reaction be different for a British or American general versus an Iranian one?
I think so, yeah. Why? There's such a divide of us versus them. I think it would be natural for us to find pride in it's us that have fought the bad guys and won.
The noise that comes out of how war gets narrated, I suppose. I'm very distrustful of anything with a British badge on it anyway, I guess, just from coming from Northern Ireland. So, I probably wouldn't have tuned into it no matter what it was. And our papers are full of scandalous things about celebrities and, Brexit-related stuff, a lot of it extremely tedious.
I think media just show us what they want us to see, and I think that explains completely why we haven't heard about this, and it would have been completely different for sure. I would have been able to know who did this and, to talk a bit more about it.
Yeah, I suppose it's like I'm just really surprised that today is the first day that I really heard about it. That seems absurd given how big the event was and how, if it was the other way around, we definitely would have heard about it. So I feel a bit ignorant that there's really been no coverage here, or at least not what I've seen.
Yeah, I think it would have been probably quite big in the media. People would have known and heard of him.
Oh, definitely. I think the media is always Western-leaning, isn't it? So, and it's easier to prop up someone who is a face that we all recognise and can get behind. That's been the case for years where... I think if the viewers don't see themselves in it, they don't relate, and therefore it's not TV worthy.
General Soleimani, who was Iranian, he's not really been recognised in the West at all, as far as I can see, for destroying ISIL. What would have been the reaction if a British or an American general had demonstrably destroyed ISIL?
Well, they would have been feted, so knighted of some sort and some sort of medal. So, yeah. I thought he was... Didn't the Americans assassinate him, fire a drone? Yeah, so I have heard of him, yeah.
Let's look at the legal issues. Washington ratified the Charter of the United Nations and is therefore bound by it. Agnes Callamard, UN Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial, Summary or Arbitrary Executions, stated the Soleimani assassination could only be justified in response to an imminent threat. She believes Washington has provided no such evidence, concluding the course of action taken by the U.S. was unlawful, adding, even at the most basic level, the U.S. did not demonstrate that striking Soleimani was necessary. Kalamard also warned it was the first targeted drone killing of a senior foreign government official on the territory of a third country, and that the world now faces the very real prospect that states may opt to strategically eliminate high-ranking military officials outside the context of a known war. The fact that by 2028, the USA aims to have 1,000 unmanned combat drones makes it the prime candidate for carrying out further such assassinations.
General Soleimani was assassinated by American operatives on the orders of then-American President Donald Trump. Does the public know this, and what do they think of the fact this killing was sponsored by a U.S. president?
I think it's completely sick. I mean, Donald Trump, he's completely crazy to me, to be honest, but to know that it's an assassination and the man is just walking free and no one has heard of it is even more insane, to be honest. Yeah, I feel sick a little bit.
I've heard of a drone strike and Donald Trump, I'm not surprised. What do I think of it? I mean, it's probably not the last drone strike that we will hear of, so I hope that we will have a right framework to deal with those things in the future.
I may be feeling cynical, but I'm not surprised, I guess. Like, I don't, and I wouldn't be surprised if Boris Johnson did the same thing. I think we're a little better than America on that front, for sure. And I grew up around people who don't behave that way and have similar surnames and all those things, but my brain still thinks that way because of the media that we're around. So it's easier for Donald Trump to just come on live TV and celebrate something that is illegal because he knows that everyone else will be like, well, that probably tracks because of the way we're kind of geared to see those things. So, like, just hearing the surname Soleimani, like, my surname's Hussein. Like, I grew up with getting teased for that, and it's like, your automatic assumptions when you ask a question like that is a bit unfortunate. So.
Outrageous, and, you know, basically, like all war crimes, you should really have it brought to justice. It shouldn't be acceptable for someone from one nation to go off and kill someone else because of whatever beliefs they have. So.
I'm not surprised. You know, I've got no time for Donald Trump, and I can't understand the support that he has, or that he has had, I suppose, but it's not like it's the first time that sort of shenanigans has gone on, I guess.
It does feel like it was a murder, and I, the fact that Trump carried it out is probably confirms in my mind that it was not a good thing.
There's a complete misalignment there with the kind of what happened. I mean, Donald Trump, I suppose, was unique, you hope, so I'm not sure how reflective that is of kind of American politics generally, but yeah, that does seem like there is something unfinished there that needs to perhaps be looked into, I guess.
If a British or an American general were assassinated on the orders of a foreign power, what would be the reaction? And to what extent does the public feel this is a classic case of double standards?
I'm sure it's been attempted, but I think if it was, there'd be a reaction from the West that the Middle East has never seen. So behind the scenes, covertly and overtly. So, which I think is the reason that the balance of orders maintained. But yeah, you're right, there's a degree of double standards, but at the same time, it's state-sponsored terrorism, isn't it? So he has been in the past implicated and proven that he's taken part in numerous attacks against the West or interests of the West.
Yeah, there would be total uproar, I think, if it happened here, because people don't believe in that sort of thing generally, do they?
Oh, I'm absolutely sure there are double standards in the world all over the place. And yeah, the reaction would have been different. If it had been the head of the British forces, it would have been all over our news. Was it all over the Iranian news? Then that's what you would expect for it to be more publicised in the relevant country. But yeah, we would have heard about it and so would the rest of the world if it had been one of ours.
And if the head of the British army was assassinated by anyone, not least from the Middle East, that there would be... it wouldn't be very good. I think it wouldn't be a pretty sight. It'd probably lead to war, yeah.
Britain's built on double standards. You know, the whole... That's what the empire is all about, you know what I mean? It's about power and control, so of course people would be outraged, you know. But, as in, you don't have to go very far to see that double standard play out again and again and again, so again, it's not surprising.
I don't know enough about it, so I'm now intrigued and interested to go and find out more. And I think part of the difficulty is that we're so often not given the facts, and that news is sold as fact, where it's not. And I think particularly in the last couple of years, we've been inundated with data and statistics, and we're either left to process them ourselves, or we're relying on someone to interpret them for us. And I think often we're sold information through news and media that's fact when it's not. And so you have to question everything behind it. And I think if someone who was British had been shot, then it would have been seen as a murder and everything. I just think I look at the word refugee and migrant, and that's what we call people who come to this country. And yet when you go abroad, a British person is called an expatriate. There's something charming about it. There's so many double standards about how we perceive where people are from and what right they have to access resources and that nationality and that country. And why were we even in Iran and Iraq in the first place? What was in it for Britain? And I think, we were probably missold while we were there in the first place.
I certainly don't think that, governments should be involved in assassinating people in general. I don't think that's their role. I don't know what Iran's reaction is to this event. So, for me, I wouldn't be able to say whether it's double standards, because I don't know, how they're perceiving it, how they're reacting to it.
I don't know if I could call it double standards, but we tend to publicly say things that are basically what the people want to hear and what the government wants to portray at the time.
The double standards, yes, but that would be a double standard.
Why did we get away with it?
Because we're in a stronger position.
Yes, there are double standards, and that's simply because the lives in the Middle East are worth less than the lives in the West, because that's the way we're all grown up to think. That's how it works. It's always been the case. The British Empire believes that they are going around and healing the earth because they think that their lives are better than the others, and that's been the case for hundreds of years. And I feel like sometimes it's better to let a country learn its own lessons and be its own culture, and that means some countries have things that we would see as distasteful or not quite what we want, but that's not necessarily meaning we need to go in and interrupt. I didn't really quite answer the direct question that you asked, but none of that stuff surprises me. It's a symptom of Western culture for the last hundreds of years, basically.
I think if that had happened, we'd be at war right now. We all know the reaction to 9/11. It was pretty unequivocal that we went straight into the Middle East. And I think if a drone strike went and killed a head of state in a UK or an American country, something similar would happen again. So. Yeah, we're absolutely guilty of double standards.
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, I feel like wherever you go, you'll find double standards. If a scenario like this would repeat itself with other people in the spotlight, the response in the media would be very different.
If a British general or an American general was assassinated because of a head of state in the Middle East saying so, what do you think would happen? Would we go into war? I mean, do you think they're a double standard?
Yeah, definitely, I do. Particularly thinking about it now, being asked... I think that there would be outcry, yeah. There'd be uproar if it was the other way around.
Are we guilty of double standards towards the Middle East?
Oh my God, completely. The double standards are really, really obvious in that case, specifically, I think, because I think the public opinion would have been completely crazy. And yeah, I think there would have been really, really heavy repercussion. The media would have used that story again and again and again, and here we are. We haven't heard of it.
I'm sure it would be headlines... terrorist attack, an Iranian person killed huge leader in the UK. They would probably use that as a justification to start another, not a war, but some kind of conflict. And I studied human geography, so we did a lot of politics, geopolitics, and it's crazy how countries just hide behind these excuses of, oh, they did this, so therefore we have to do this to counter it. But
General Qasem Soleimani was killed by America, but mourned by Iran and many others. Yet few in the West have any real idea about the huge contribution the general made in putting right what the West did wrong, especially in relation to